You're listening to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we present a 1969 speech by blacklisted radio personality John Henry Falk entitled, What Happens to a Democratic Society When Fear is Rampant?
I'll tell you the story of John Henry Falk. I'll tell you of his trials and the trouble trail he walked. And I'll tell you of the tyrants, the ones you never see. Murder is the role they play and hatred is their fee. On the TV and the radio, John Henry Falk was known. He talked to many thousands with a mind that was his own. But he could not close his eyes when the list were passed around. So he tried to move the union to tear the blacklist down. His friends, they tried to warn him he was heading for a fall. If he spoke against the blacklist, he had no chance at all. But he laughed away their warnings and he laughed away their fears. For how could lies destroy the work of many honest years? Then slowly, oh so slowly, his life began to change. People would avoid his eyes, his friends were acting strange. And he finally saw the power of the hidden poison pen. When they told him that his job was through, he'd never work again. And he could not believe what his sad eyes had found. He stared in disbelief as his world came tumbling down. And as the noose grew tighter, at last the trap was clear. For every place he turned to go, that list would soon be there. Oh, that list. And is there any bottom to the fears that grow inside?
Well, the long and short of it was that my side dissolved all of a sudden in the union. And I'd keep running up and down the ranks, kind of like poor old Tom Paine, I guess, with not nearly as much sense or as much wisdom nor as much inspiration as he did say, listen, hell, we won, let's go ahead. You knew they was going to say that about us. That's McCarthy trick. God, these guys all went over and joined aware, about half of them did, to make themselves safe, to prove that they had not been victimized by this villain. This is what fear will do to a society, and it was a shocking and unbelievable experience to me. Then a CBS called me in and said, listen, you've had it. They're after you. They're knocking your sponsors off, Johnny. Unless you can sign an affidavit that you did these things, but you did them as a dupe and a stupid ass, and you apologize, and that Aware is really saving the country, and unless you'll pay Aware off, is what they were saying to me, you're a dead duck. Now, this is within your lifetime, really. Thank God you weren't old enough to really dig the scene. But this was what was going on. And hell, I went home and pondered it a while. And you see, Daddy fought the Ku Klux Klan way back down out there in Travis County. Y'all ought to have seen it in the 1920s when it was really riding high. Hell, he'd come to church wearing the hoods and everything, you know. And so Daddy jumped him. And I remember a bunch of citizens came to him and said, what a courageous thing, Judge Falk, for you to do, jump the Ku Klux Klan. And he said, look, somebody has to do it. Everybody loathes and despises them. It takes no courage to do it. What it only suggests is that if you see evil being committed in your community and you turn your face because you think it's more convenient to escape it, then you become part of the evil. You become a participant willy-nilly. And so I deserve no credit for this, says Daddy. And I remembered this. Well, at any rate, you see, Aware had always operated secretly, and they never could get the hands on anything that they'd say about you because the networks didn't want to get involved, the agencies didn't want to get involved, nobody wanted to be involved. Well, two of these left-wing outfits, seriously, Schlitz Beer and Coca-Cola Bottling Works, brought me what they were sending them, threatening them if they didn't drop their sponsorship of me, that they would attack the companies. And so I had material in my hands. Ed Murrow, who was a great and dear friend of mine there at CBS, said, Johnny, by God, let's go for them. Let's cut their heart out. Let's sue them. And I said, I'm sure for that. Drag them into court and let them prove their charges. Sue them for a libel, a conspiracy to libel. You see, they're perfectly welcome to call me a communist, Seventh-day Adventist, anything you wanted to. But it was another thing to conspire to go to my sponsors to threaten them if they didn't fire me. And that's very important to understand. Free speech is very, very good, but when you start saying you got to fire a guy, by God, we're going to destroy you, then you're conspiring to destroy him, see? Well, at any rate, I went down and got the meanest lawyer on earth, and any of you children ever get a lawyer, get somebody like Nizer. God, a disposition like an old mad merino goat. Lord have mercy. He goes after the opposition, very vain, see? And when he goes after somebody, he goes after the jugular vein. Well, we got him to take the case, paid him off, old Ed and I did, and we were in the suit. Sued him for conspiracy to libel me. Well, it's off and running, and I was giving myself airs, as I told y'all before. I was kind of feeling sassy and ugly, and also that I was a pretty dynamic personality, and I was doing things for America. Hell, then CBS fired me. I thought they'd all rejoice. Everybody would run, grab my hand, pump it, and say, Johnny, because it was front page news in all the Hollywood and New York papers. Falk sues aware. They'd never been sued. They'd never been hauled into court before. Instead of that, people began to walk on the other side of the street if I came by like I was carrying a disease. And began to avoid me. And CBS fired me. And I was what was called blacklisted. And it's a weird situation, folks. You have no idea what it's like to be accused of a crime that is so nebulous that there's no way to put your finger on it. And what the hell am I going to do? Run down Madison Avenue screaming, and whatever they say is a lie. It ain't true. You can't do it, see? And you realize that people are avoiding you, or guys are getting up and moving when you sit down and wrestling. It's the weirdest feeling in the world. And you can say, well, they're just cowards, and your best friends will come to you and say, listen, Johnny, we know it's all a damn lie, and we know it's terrible, but we'll have to cancel that dinner and day engagement we had next week. You're hot now. Can't be touched. God, it does things to you. And they put the starvation bit to you, see? Your income stops, and old Con Edison and Bell Telephone wants a damn pay every month, see? And so does your guy that's renting me this 11-room apartment I was in with the 4 bathrooms. And you get nervous and jittery, and you're not sure what the hell is happening. It's strange and weird feelings happen to you because you know you got the talent, or you think you have, and then you ain't sure you have. And maybe, because nobody ever tells you that's the reason you can't get a job. Nothing's ever said. Suddenly, they're giving you excuses. Well, we've got another guy. We've got a guy coming in from Los Angeles going to do that, take that part, Johnny, we had for you. And that sort of thing. And it's weird. And you're hungry. And they're threatening to shut off things. And you're borrowing money from guys, see? And you know they're embarrassed because they might be charged with aiding and abetting you if you're put in jail or something. And it's really a strange thing happened. Then old Nizer, 6 months later, Nizer calls me and said, listen, they're willing to settle. Roy Cohn, y'all don't remember. Roy Cohn was a McCarthy character with Cohn Shine. So they're willing to settle with a big apology, and maybe they'll give you some money, Johnny, because they don't want to go through with their suit. You ready? And you're starving to death. But I had a secret weapon. And y'all always get a secret weapon. See, I had a secret weapon. Most of these people that had to capitulate to aware, and many hundreds of people had, and they literally persecuted people until they committed suicide. Some half dozen very prominent performers had committed suicide. You have any idea what this blank, black fog of blacklisting is like? It's a grim thing because people have charged you with things. Just like Frank Irwin saying, SDS, a minority group, in those sinister terms. The hell are you going to reply? I ain't no minority group. What are you going to do? Run up and grab. See, they know what they're doing when they pull this kind of crap. So, at any rate, I had this secret weapon, though. See, I come from a long line of visitors in Travis County. The folks are the visitingest damn family on earth, of each other. I had Aunt Edith and Glenn Baby and Claudia, her children, and Ashford and Bert May used to come for Thanksgiving and protest that they really couldn't stay for dinner. Aunt Edith drive up from Magnolia, Texas. Really can't stay. Oh, Miss Maddie, I know y'all wasn't expecting us. Y'all go on eat, and we'll just watch you, and if there's anything left, we'll eat it. And Mama'd say, no, Edith, now y'all got to stay on. I've got worlds of victuals out. Incidentally, I was born and raised in a place called Green Pastures out here. That's my old family home. My nephew's now running it, but it wasn't an eating place. It was kind of an eating place then, except we didn't get no money for it. But anyway, that's where I was born and raised. And you know there's a lot of room out there. And so and Mom would say, "Ain't Edith stay. Now, Edith, you got to stay. Try to stay till Sunday, honey, because we haven't visited in so long. Oh, Miss Maddie, if you got some old raggedy quilts the children sleep on, pallets, and I set to sleep in the car." Thing is, Aunt Edith wouldn't leave till next Easter, see, ever. But this was a little ritual we'd go through. It was kind of ceremony us Southerners went through. Aware didn't know this. Hello, Captain John Talley, one of Mama's cousins, came in to visit us one Sunday afternoon in 1936 and left just after World War II. So what I did, I came home and visited. I came back to Austin and visited family. And Aware didn't reckon with this, see. And it's 6 years, I was blacklisted, 6 years. It was grim hell, really. But then Nizer calls me from New York and says, "We're coming to court." And I go sailing back to New York. Already the triumphal hero returns. And I knew that all New York would be standing on his ear waiting for John Henry Falk to come back. And that all of my compatriots and peers in the entertainment industry would be lined up to shake my hand. I went down to Toot Shores, which is a theatrical restaurant where you run into all your buddies. And sure enough, here are two of my friends. And I was trying to be modest that I'd back after 6 years, you know, and walked in. And one of them said, "Hey, there's Johnny Falk. Hey, Johnny, want a drink?" I walked over, realizing that they were obviously terribly impressed to see me back, just waiting to hear what the word was. One of them said, "Johnny, hell, I ain't run into you last month or so. You been out of town?" Mago went down the other and said, "Weren't you involved in a suit here this year or last year? I forget which. Did you ever win it or lose it?" And that was the end. I realized then that, by God, that nobody really gave a particular damn in the business. Until Louis Nizer started framing the suit up, kids. And I wish y'all been there in New York. He got all of the reporters from all the New York press, the Washington press, and from London and Paris press there, intensely interested in what was going to happen in this great cause case. He stages a case very much like George Abbott stages a Broadway show. He gets all the juice there is to get out of it. We had the damnedest line of witnesses you ever laid eyes on. Man, everybody nationally known. We use nothing but nationally known witnesses to tell about the sins and ugliness of Aware. And poor old Aware looked like a couple of ragged damn kids after a Halloween party turned somebody's toilet over. They kind of looked kind of, you know, with the mask off and they looked kind of sick. No effort whatever during the entire 3 months of the trial. Every day on the front page, all of Broadway and all of Hollywood there, see what came out. Not because of me. See what happened to Aware, who had hit them all, see, and shook them all down. And the revelations that came out were pretty shocking. And the real nature of a vigilante group in this society, what they were really up to, came out. They didn't even believe their own charges because they neither brought witnesses nor any evidence to suggest that I was other than the most loyal, red-blooded American. All they did was try to defend themselves and mitigate their damages by saying, "We never said anything about him. We just," the court said, "Oh, yes, you did. The innuendo was that he's less than loyal, and you'd better prove that he is, or by God, you in trouble." The jury sat there for the whole 3 months. And God, I wish y'all could have seen the case. Nizer started describing what happened to me. Woo! I cried. My God, I didn't know it. I didn't know it had been that hideous. And then he'd get me on stand and direct. And you see, I'm Methodist from out in South Austin. And he'd say, "When you were 11 years old, Mr. Falk, did you ever get a gold star?" And I said, "Yes, sir." What was that gold star for, Miss Falk?" I said, "It's given by the Fred Allen Memorial Methodist Church for 72 Sundays without a miss." And old Nigel would pump it into that jury, you know. He didn't ever ask me, "Well, did your mama make you go?" Which was the fact, which was the only damn reason I was there, as a matter of fact. Because I pretty early broke off from Methodist Church from just voluntary attendance, I'll have to say. But at any rate, he'd use this kind of technique. Well, at the end of 3 months, and the whole pressure had built up, a damn jury sitting there didn't have no more expression on the face than a side of bacon. I couldn't tell whether win or lose. And Nizer gets up in the closing arguments and asks for $2 million damages. Well, you know, my feelings had been hurt. But my God, $2 million damages. That's another matter. I figured the jury'd think the whole thing had been a fraud and a joke. They go marching out. Nizer says, well, if they come back soon, now we'll go down to dinner, but if they come back early, that means we done won. They'll come in for you. And I said, well, I wish you hadn't asked for $2 million, Lou, because, my God, they think it's all a joke. Know what I'm doing? See, he'd taken $5 million off poor Winthrop Rockefeller for Bobo during their divorce, and he's, you know, he had his heirs about $1 million. So, sure enough, here comes a runner down from the court saying the judge wants you in the court and all the newspaper men. And by this time, the damn case had built up a terrific powerhouse there in New York. Everybody come running. We sit down there, you know, virtuous-like. And the foreman of jury gets up. Judge said, have you reached your decision? He said, no. We want to ask if we can give more than $2 million. Well, Nizer had made a lot of mistakes, but asking for too little had never been one of them. He looked just like somebody caught him between the eyes with a ball-peen hammer. So the jury went out in 15 minutes, came back with a judgment of $3.5 million awarded to John Henry Falk. And I didn't even know what it meant. I was just sitting there numb by this time. Hell, I was the only Falk ever had that sum of money associated with his name, except in debt. And I didn't get the money. The defendants were, partially insolvent. Got $175,000, rather than Nizer did, which went to pay for the case, which ran about $500,000. The jury didn't give $103.5 million to me, incidentally, and I want to make this very clear to you. It had nothing to do with John Henry Falk and whether he was a $3.5 million talent or a 10-cent talent. It had to do with a group of American citizens, very much like yourselves, 12 of them, men and women, black and white, sitting there and listening to all of the pro and cons of the case, the truth. You know, up here on the front end of the main building, they got the truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Magnificent and beautiful statement. They listened to the truth. All the truth is adduced by the defendants. All the truth is adduced by me. And decided that this mustn't happen in our American society again. This is what they were saying, nothing about me at all with $3.5 million. They're saying, damn it, this has got to stop. If this is what McCarthyism is about, if this is what fear and intimidation is about, then we've got to stop it. And their decision was cut by the appellate division, just the sum, but not one word of their findings were cut. Went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused a writ of certiorari, and the case was over. I didn't get the money, but here's what I want to share with you. I got something far more important than that, more important to you and more pertinent to us today than money. Number one, I got a chance to look into what happened after World War II in this society that you have been raised in. What happened when vigilantism took over? A vigilante, by definition, is one that believes that the laws of the land and the institution for administering those laws are not sufficient, and that the vigilante himself must pass his own laws, set up his own institutions of justice, and administer that justice. The vigilante becomes the judge, the jury, the prosecuting attorney on our society. You were raised in a generation where has become an accepted fact of life in our society. The vigilante becomes not only the judge, the jury, the prosecuting attorney, but the executioner on the lives of those that are his victims. The vigilantism in our society is the sine qua non, uses a sine qua non fear. He cannot function without fear. Threats, opprobrium, And we entered a period in American society where the epithet, the accusing finger, the charge, where the attack was on those who would correct injustices rather than on the injustice, if you understand what I mean. And this is what vigilantism was all about. And I got a chance to examine it at length. But far more important than that, this experience afforded me an opportunity in 6 years of leisure, kind of leisure, to look into the nature of American society. And this is the thought that I wanted to leave to you today. I had a chance to go back and read the origins of our society and to study where we had come from and who we were. Who were these people that came to these shores and that set up a government here? And it was a breathtaking experience. I learned it all, like most of you have, in high school, junior high. But I'd never understood it before in the context of what is happening in America today. See, if you will only read that period of time from the, oh, just 1760s to 1776, when the British establishment, thank you, sir, when the British establishment was passing its punitive laws and the American colonists were protesting the injustices to which they were visited, and listen to the speeches of the British. Read the speeches again of Lord North, of the Earl of Sandwich, of King George III, and how they responded to the protests of injustice that was going on in our society over here. And it'll remind you of Richard Nixon to a fare thee well. To the whole damned establishment. The names that John Hancock, that Samuel Adams, that Thomas Jefferson, that one patriot after another that we now hold in such deep respect were called by the British establishment, the law and order of the day, the established government of the day. The names that they were called make Spiro Agnew and Frank Irwin look like Packers. They can't think up the kind of names that were hurled at the contemptible and vicious, savage, ugly American colonists that would dare presume to protest injustice of His Majesty's government. Read this, as I did. It's a very illuminating experience. And secondly, read about the men after that. After the issue was forced, the revolution was fought, it foregathered in 1778. This I would implore you to do because it has a profound meaning to each and every one of you sitting here today, to every American citizen indeed in these very troubled times. The man who saw that the resort to violence was the only means of overthrowing the tyrannical forces that held them in check, the government of King George III, an insensible and deaf man to the pleas for justice, but were determined to set up a government where violence wouldn't be necessary, where injustices could be protected and could be corrected without the resort to violence. Foregathered there in Philadelphia in 1778, or 87, and all summer long swatted mosquitoes and flies. Men, each one of whom had been just 10, 12 years before regarded as a traitor, guilty of treason. Men who understood the history of oppression and how governments all, lo, these many centuries, authoritarian governments, had repressed and shocked people of their right to walk in dignity and humanity. And set there in frame of this magnificent umbrella called the Constitution of the United States. Well, the proof of the pudding is in the last 200 years. You're all heirs to that. And the deep sense that I got out of my case, this experience that I had, made me want to come before you all tonight. Because you see, I am utterly convinced that out of that McCarthy period of 15 years ago, of which I was a participant, And don't get any notion that there's anything courageous nor even semi-courageous about me. I make my wife change the light fixtures if I think there's a short in. But I did understand one thing that we're all heirs to. And this is what I would like to communicate to you if I communicated nothing else to you tonight. That we have the weapons in our own hand. The people's voice in this country is the most frightening and terrifying thing to those usurpers of power, those men who would overstep the bounds of the powers we've delegated to them. All I'm saying to you is, and the reason I'm very privileged to be here and very honored to be here with you tonight, is that this country, and God knows how we did it, because my generation contributed damn little to it, have produced in you the most ethical and moral generation this country has produced in 175 years, and it's always an honor to address a youthful audience. God knows if you can't make it, kids, we're a doomed people. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to From the Vault, John Henry Falk, What Happens to a Democratic Society When Fear is Rampant? From the Vault is broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network with 5 stations in Berkeley, Los Angeles, New York City, Washington, D.C., Houston, Texas, and 120 affiliates nationwide.